You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, January 13th, 2021. My name... 2022. My name is Emma Vigeland, in for Sam Steeder, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Rachel Greenwald Smith, author of On Compromise, Art, Politics, and the Fate of the American Ideal. Meanwhile, the Omicron wave has appeared to slow down just a bit in New York City and other areas of the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic, which is a promising sign that we could be peaking and seeing a steep drop-off like the UK is currently seeing. But still get your booster and mask up, which might become easier. Smooth transition. If Bernie Sanders' new legislation passes... Sanders and 50 other Democratic lawmakers have introduced a bill that would send three N95 masks to all Americans via the USPS. Seems like common sense, and honestly, we probably should have done that.
Welcome
really
to modernity.
On. Yep. But globally, Omicron is still wreaking havoc, especially in places where the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are still rare. The WHO estimates that there were 15 million new COVID infections just last week. In January 6th committee news, Kayleigh McEnany was interviewed yesterday, while top House Republican Kevin McCarthy has announced he will not cooperate. It was a voluntary thing, so we'll see if they try to force him. Speaking of people not cooperating, Biden is having a lunch meeting with Senate Democrats today in order to push Sinema and Manchin to support a filibuster carve-out for voting rights. Good luck after you let Manchin kill Build Back Better. He's feeling himself. The Ohio Supreme Court has struck down Republicans' heavy gerrymandered state map, which would have maintained GOP control of the state house. They now have 10 days to submit a new map. And lastly, an 80-year-old Palestinian-American man named Omar Abdulmajid Assad was killed and died, allegedly killed by the IDF in the occupied West Bank. He was found dead and handcuffed in an abandoned building after a police interaction. So yet another reminder about the power dynamics at play there. It's not two sides, it's one dominant actor. All this and more on today's program. Welcome to the show, ladies and gentlemen. It is the Majority Report. Sam is out today on Thursdays, but we do have a great show for you today. When the cat's away, the mice play.
Sam is a giant cat.
Yeah. I don't know if he'd like to be compared to a cat, given the disdain he has for his own cats. He loves them secretly, but...
Yeah, well, he does a lot for them, so I think that's love.
Yes, yes, exactly. they have illnesses. So, I'm hopeful that we've seen the worst of Omicron right now. Obviously, Matt, you've had to experience COVID. It's been all over the place throughout the city. More than half of my friends, I feel like, contracted it in December. But I'm seeing just anecdotally lines outside these mobile testing.
Well, the capacity is there now. It's interesting. Yeah. Like, I'm seeing a lot more testing sites, but a lot less quality, as we kind of alluded to yesterday.
Yes.
Like, it seems like people just got, like, tents and they're like, sitting with clipboards. I don't quite understand the professionality, but that's how we do it in America. We do it late, but for profit.
Yeah, I walked past one of the testing sites the other day, and I just, there was no line, and I asked, and they said actually it would take 2 to 3 days, but I had an appointment to get one that would have taken a shorter period of time. But the font was like bolded Comic Sans, and like there was no branding on on the sign, and I'm just like, is this one of the fake COVID testing sites that we covered yesterday? There's no way to know.
And they're trying to like get you to take it just walking past, get anybody to go get a COVID test, which I guess I kind of like is fine, but you understand what the motivation is. It's because they're getting kickbacks for every test that they do.
Yeah. And another just quick anecdote, when I was waiting for a test a few weeks ago, someone was there clearly from Europe. And he did not have an insurance card because he assumed and had waited in line with me for like 2.5 hours. And he gets to the counter and she's like, well, $150. So that's what we're dealing with. And I think
a lesson for America for your friend.
Yeah. He was just somebody I met in line, but he needed it to get back home. So it's absurd. But, speaking of COVID, the Republicans continue to dabble in anti-vax misinformation, except for really one. I mean, for now. This is the guy that said, maybe you should inject bleach into your body. Maybe you should put a UV light in your lungs. I don't know. Maybe that'll fix COVID.
Yeah, this is a relatively pro-vax guy, or pro-good medical information guy, even with all that said, compared to most Republicans.
Exactly. Yeah, because then once the vaccine arrived, he wanted to take credit for it. Donald Trump. It sounds crazy, but if he runs in 2024, he will be the most pro-vaccine legitimate contender for the Republican nomination.
And what's so good about Trump and kind of what's evident here is he's not thirsty for the fans as much. Like, he has a little bit of disdain, right? He's leaving them in the cold, in like Omaha, going to rallies and stuff during coronavirus.
Yes.
But and the other ones are thirsty for them, so they can't really turn away from this sort of anti-vaxxery. Trump has the independence because he doesn't really care about these people.
Well, he, as you say, he has disdain for the evangelical base that's at the heart of this anti-vax movement, the people that he thinks are behaving irrationally and are not the kinds he wants the adoration, but he really finds them to be a bit grimy. So I did not think that we would be saying that Donald Trump, of the actual people that could win the Republican nomination in 2024, would be the most pro-vax, but he is. And part of this is self-interest. He wants to take credit for the vaccine, and also because he has no patience for this garbage, where, as Matt says, someone like DeSantis, who he uses this opportunity to take a not so subtle shot at here, he has to engage in that. So here he is speaking to OAN, where he does take a not so subtle shot at DeSantis, because DeSantis may be cosplaying, you know, as Trump. He may be
he's doing my hand motions.
Yeah, right. I mean, watch that side by side. The DeSantis is trying to copy him. So he's the carbon copy, but there's nothing like the real deal, the real pure stuff. Here's Trump on OAN.
We'll get to in a second, but the other one was the vaccine.
Right.
You recently stated in an interview with Candace Owens, and when you were on the road with Bill O'Reilly doing the book tour and the speaking engagement, that you've had the vaccine, two shots, and you've had the booster.
Right.
And you recommend it for folks. We have seen with the VAERS report, there's tens of thousands of side effects, more side effects in this vax than any vax in history.
And more deaths.
Dr. Robert Malone.
There is no VAERS report.
Yeah.
VAERS is a site where people can, and there's no vetting process. Any anti-vaxxer who claims that the vaccine, you know, made them radioactive or magnetic, they can post on this VAERS aggregating data website. There's no report. It's just a place where you can file a complaint and say, hey, I experienced these symptoms from whatever, and it's compiled there, and there's no...
And then you try to find patterns if there is some that exists. But yeah, the thing that there's so much with VAERS with the COVID vaccines, and not for, say, like other vaccinations, is because the COVID vaccine is the entire population at the same time, and also politicized by a political party. So there's a whole lot more awareness that, like, maybe this... Like, people get paranoid in this environment,
yes!
Right? And there is a limited number of things where people will have some reaction to the vaccines, but the VAERS reports are like absolutely like you can I could go on there and say like the vaccine made me fly to work and now I can't walk anymore. And it'd be like, oh, look at that. Oh, that's something we need to look at. Like,
the VAERS report?
Yeah, huh. Exactly. Look at the VAERS
report. They said that. Wow. Yeah. All right. But continue.
9 patents for the mRNA technology being used in the vaccines. He came on my program a couple weeks ago and said, unless you're over 65 and have a comorbidity, I recommend it. Other than that, I don't recommend taking it. He even is upset he took it himself. He's having heart issues. Looking back, we know that Warp Speed was great. You did amazing with getting rid of red tape to get something out of there.
I'm sorry.
But after now so many...
Go back to Donald Trump just staring at him, and he's just like, how am I letting this guy speak for this long without me interrupting?
Excuse me. You say heart issues. I'll have you know that myocarditis happens even more frequently with coronavirus itself. So that might have happened. And also... Yeah, like myocarditis, it does happen. It can be an impact from things like the common cold. So you know what? Stop fear mongering.
Yeah, I love. I want to there to be a new character, epidemiologist Trump. Okay, but he is so bored. He has not been able to talk for a full 30 seconds. Keep going.
Looking back, we know that Warp Speed was great. You did amazing with getting rid of red tape to get something out there. But after now so many months of the vaccine being administered and these side effects and Americans' questions of it, do you reconsider your push for it, or what's your view now on the vaccine in general?
Well, I've taken it. I've had the booster. Yep. Many politicians, I watched a couple of politicians be interviewed, and one of the questions was, did you get the booster? Because they had the vaccine. And they're answering it like, in other words, the answer is yes, but they don't want to say it. Because they're gutless. You've got to say it. Whether you had it or not, say it. Right. But the fact is that I think the vaccine has saved tens of millions of people throughout the world. I have had absolutely no side effects. I've had it like other people have had it, nothing special. I've had it.
Do you feel for the millions of Americans that have it, though? There's over 100 million that haven't taken it yet. And they have questions, especially younger people with the myocarditis and things.
I don't think young, healthy people should take it. Okay. I don't think that certainly these young kids, their immune system is so strong. I look at I have a son, Baron.
Yeah, so this 15. Is where
had it. It lasted for about 2 seconds, yeah. Okay? I said, oh, we've got it. Baron, you've got it. And, like, by the time we called the doctor, it was gone. You know, they have a very strong immune system.
By the time we called the doctor, I was gone. I said, oh, Baron, you got it. Bye-bye. no more attention paid to you.
But you see how, like, the way Trump, like, Trump's way, as opposed, like, there's nothing, like, people say they're criticizing pharma by being against these vaccines. But at the same time, Trump is right when he says, like, this could save tens of millions of people. It'd save even more if we could all be sort of united in saying, hey, we need to extend this technology worldwide and the knowledge to how to produce it. But when you say, like, actually there's a lot of people everywhere from OAN to Jimmy Dore has questions about, like, is this actually, like, some sort of conspiracy of pharma, then that question about extending it to the rest of the world isn't one you would ask, because why would you want to extend the conspiracy to them, too?
Exactly. But it is just fascinating here when he sees, whenever Trump sees an opportunity to be the alpha, that will take precedence over any of this, like, culture war vaccine stuff that he feels is silly and doesn't necessarily want to engage in. He sees an opportunity here to be like, DeSantis is a loser. He's not, just admit it. Like, I did. I'm the one telling you the truth. And then you're kind of like at a throwback to 2015, 2016, where that was his whole aesthetic to the Republicans. I'm saying the real stuff. I'm not pandering to you, and I'm saying exactly what you are thinking.
Yeah, and also the idea that only people that are old, like, these are probabilities, but you can really help your or really get rid of the risk that you have of being hospitalized by getting the vaccine. So yes. Even young people, even kids should be vaccinated.
Exactly. And that's not what they're thinking with the vaccine. I just meant back in 2015, 2016 when he was saying the racist stuff. But that really, that paired with his just like big dogging of the rest of the Republican nominees on stage, that's what got him the nomination. And he's already starting there with DeSantis. Why are you so scared? Why are you a liar? It's effective. And I'm the one who took it, and I'm the one that created it. So.
Stop fear-mongering about myocarditis.
Just a reminder that he's good at this stuff with the bass. All right, we got to take a quick break. When we come back, we will be joined by Rachel Greenwald-Smith, author of On Compromise, Art, Politics, and the Fate of the American Ideal. We are back, and we are joined by Rachel Greenwald-Smith, author of On Compromise, Art, Politics, and the Fate of an American Ideal. Rachel, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
I'm excited to talk about your book because I think the concept of as a leftist, when I hear compromise, it makes my blood boil, right? But in many ways, Biden really ran and won as a compromise candidate, right? I am the unity candidate. I am against divisiveness and I'll bring people together, which really means I will compromise with the Republicans who are vile and I will give them part of what they want. And to that makes me want to vomit everywhere, but there is a literacy in this country where people find that appealing, or I guess a muscle memory, I should say. So why is that message so potent to many Americans?
Yeah, thanks for that. I mean, one of the answers I give in my book is that compromise has become something more than a practice that we engage in. It's become a sort of ethos or a moral attitude that we have come to sort of appreciate without thinking very hard about what compromise actually entails. So early in the book, I make a distinction between compromise as a means and compromise as an end. And when I talk about compromise as a means, what I mean is what most of us do every day in our workplaces and homes where we engage in conflict and have to really work out hard with other people how we can get along despite our disagreements. And when we make those compromises, we usually don't enjoy them. They usually entail a certain amount of loss, a certain amount of anger, maybe some resentment, maybe some hopes that things will get better or that we'll get our own way eventually. But I contrast that notion of compromise as a means with what I think you're talking about and what I think Biden ran on, which is the compromise as an end. The idea that compromise is a good into itself, something we should aspire to, something we should want, and that people who are good compromisers are both morally and politically preferable to those who aren't.
Right. And something you brought up in your book, which I never thought about this way and was just so well said on the individual level, which you mentioned, compromise can seem like a way to inure regular people to the harshest consequences of capitalism as well. Talk a little bit about that concept.
Sure. So, I mean, capitalism demands compromise in a really brutal way on a number of levels. It turns those of us who don't agree with exploitation into exploiters, kind of by necessity, as we buy products that are made through process of exploitation and as we are ourselves exploited as workers. And it makes the compromises that we have to make in order to share resources harder because it drives scarcity by concentrating resources at the top and making the rest of us scramble for what is left. So compromise and capitalism to me are very much tangled up. And I think as a result, valuing compromise ends up turning around and often encouraging us to sort of implicitly accept the conditions that capitalism has given us when we really should be fighting against them.
And is that by, I mean, that seems to be by design. It allows people to, you know, we've been talking a lot about the GOP's push for critical race theory and how that allows it, it's basically designed to not just make our children not question our systems, but make them idealize them. And if you're also conditioning people to be good compromisers in relation to power structures, that seems to have a similar effect of protecting a class of people.
I think that's right. And I think sometimes it's by design and sometimes it's sort of a matter of just accepting things as they are and not pushing back very hard. So, I mean, for me, the particular way that compromise is functioning in our current moment politically on the left starts with the Clinton administration in the 1990s and the sort of acceptance of neoliberalization that we saw under that administration. So it was with that, with the turn to Clinton era Democratic politics here, I mean, and this was tracking, of course, abroad in the Tony Blair administration and elsewhere, we start to see the left give up on sort of socialist valences of thinking about redistributing wealth, of critiquing capitalism in any meaningful way. And it's exactly at that point where we start to see the language of centrism, of third ways, and of compromise really take hold in the Democratic Party.
Right. I mean, including a think tank called Third Way. Yes. they should have just called it compromise or something like that. But I mean, like, that is another thing that you wrote about that I thought was really just well said. The how compromise became an inherent or is an inherent value in liberalism, which I guess you can kind of more broadly talk about it as a value, or not more broadly, but you can point to it as a value of neoliberalism, certainly as well. What did you mean by that?
By liberalism or
by how compromise was inherent to liberalism?
Yeah, I mean, liberalism, of course, has so many definitions, like the sort of fuzzy target. And one of the reasons why I'm interested in taking on sort of liberalism as a whole in a book about compromise is that when one tries to sort of combat liberalism as a logic, one immediately seems like a nasty extremist who's likely to be in bed with all sorts of people one doesn't want to be in bed with. So because liberalism entails not only values of freedom and liberty, of course, but also values of moderation, rational discourse, things that most of us would like to believe in. So, I think I take on liberalism in two different ways in the book. On one hand, I take on compromise as a central liberal value, because it is something we're taught to do as good liberal subjects when we engage in negotiations, is to compromise. But also in saying that I think there's a role for forms of discourse that are not compromising, I'm bringing in an opportunity to take on values like liberalism that I think require a sort of more strident approach.
And how do you draw a distinction between, say, liberalism and your perception of progressivism or leftism? Because I think our power structures would say that's orthodoxy, as opposed to morality.
Yeah. So my definition of liberalism as opposed to sort of the politics I'm embracing, I suppose, for me, since my background is in art and literature, I sort of start maybe counterintuitively, especially for your audience, which are probably mostly people more politically savvy than I am. But I start looking at the arts and the distinction between works of art that take these very strong stands, avant-gardist and experimental works that really try to challenge people, as opposed to works of art that sort of play to the market, that play to your average reader, that sort of aim themselves at larger audiences. And I think I see something analogous in political sensibilities. So, yes, we have these really clear, I think, partisan divides within the left, even between, say, the Bernie Sanders social democracy contingent and the sort of more centrist Biden contingent, for instance. But I think that those are policy differences, and they're very, and I feel very strongly on the left of that spectrum myself in terms of my own politics. But there are also, I think, attitudinal differences between those two positions. And those are where I think seeing the analogous relationship to art is very instructive in the sense that I think there's as much in some ways a sort of aesthetic difference between certain forms of leftism and others as there is a policy difference. And you hear the sort of attitude policing all the time from the center toward the left. It's not so much that they say, like, you shouldn't have a $15 minimum wage. It's sort of, it's much more commonly, well, you're not being patient. You're not being, you're not waiting for incrementalism to do its work. You're asking too much. You're being too loud. And it's those kind of aesthetic properties of the political disagreement that I think are really revealed by looking at these things in relation to similar trends in works of art.
Well, so then let's talk a little bit about the you mentioned the avant-garde art from the 20th century that you focus on as well. What were some of the things, based on your background in art, that you found closely parallel a lot of these political dynamics?
Sure. So one of the figures I look at is an avant-gardist publisher, Margaret Anderson, who is the publisher of what was called at the time a little magazine, which were, I mean, maybe the blogs of the 19-teens. And she published a lot of early works of modernism. She was the first person to publish James Joyce's Ulysses in a serial format, for instance. And she was herself a very uncompromising figure. She, at one point, I write about how she so objected to the sort of mediocre quality of the work that she herself was publishing, that she said if she didn't have a really great piece for her next issue, she would leave blank pages in the issue. And she did, because she just refused to publish things she didn't think were extremely wonderful. She also slept in a tent on the edge of Lake Michigan for a while because she was kicked out of her offices because she couldn't afford her rent. So I'm interested in her sort of wonderful, uncompromising attitude as a woman, as a feminist, and as a publisher. But also, she had this incredible column in her magazine called The Reader Critic, where she would allow individual readers from all over the country to write in. And often the things that they wrote were actually quite either hostile or critical of the work that she was publishing. And she would write back to them in the column, where she would defend her choices or admit that she was wrong. And I argue in the book that that model is maybe a much better model for what democracy can look like than the notion that we all need to get along or that there needs to be some sort of general consensus about what we need to do to go forward. That the sort of combative public space that she opens up around a conversation about art is something that we should also be looking for in our politics.
And another example as well is the punk scene that you talk about, which is another Jason from the This Is Revolution podcast on and to talk about a lot of the punk scene and like much of the same relationship with art that you're fleshing out here. But I'm curious about your take on it. What are some of the lessons gleaned from the punk scene about not selling out or not compromising, as you say, that can be also reflected back onto the political spectrum?
Sure. I mean, punk's really complicated because it's not at all politically stable. And a lot of the examples I look at of art that's sort of uncompromising are works that don't take maybe exactly the political position that some of us would want them to take. And I think that, too, is instructive. So I look at punk as a sort of ethos of refusal that can give us a lot of hope for what refusal can look like, but also has some cautionary aspects. So one of the things I do talk about is Gavin McInnes, the Proud Boys leader and Vice Media founder, his own background in punk and how we should be aware of the fact that punk has its own sort of entanglements with the far right. But on the other hand, I talk about Kathleen Hanna, the lead singer of Bikini Kill, a very important feminist punk band from the 1990s, and her struggle to think politically about how she wanted her art movement to move forward. I find her to be a really useful figure because she was working very hard to make her movement as inclusive as possible. But in the process of trying to include everyone, she still ended up with a movement that was primarily white, middle class, suburban. And so I'm thinking in that chapter in which I think about Riot Girl, about how in some ways structure can sometimes lead to more inclusive political structures than sort of open season kind of anything goes.
Yeah, I mean, I'm such a dork and I don't know anything about punk. So like, I mean, but what it does remind me of a little bit is like the juxtaposition of the grunge movement of the 90s versus the glam, the glam rock where I can't even think of one band. Guns N' Roses, would they be included in that? See, this
T-Rex is more glam.
Okay. Sure. But I mean, that seems like a similar contrast.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose the contrast that I'm interested in within punk has to do with thinking about different ways that movements that want to refuse the mainstream go about doing it. And in the case of Riot Girl, they were really interested in what it would mean to kind of get rid of hierarchy altogether, because they were so upset by the way that women were being treated at punk shows by male punk musicians and punk bands, and they felt that was a result of a sort of hierarchical masculinist tendency in male punk bands. And so they thought if they removed hierarchy, that they would have this wonderful feminist collective that could just do anything. And they had that one of their slogans was, revolutionary girl power now, you know, they really, which is very inspiring. However, you know, I write about my own experience growing up in Portland, Oregon during the 1990s. And I was a little bit younger than most of the people who were really involved in the movement, trying to find them. Like, I desperately wanted to be part of this movement, but because there wasn't any sort of structure, there wasn't any sort of intention behind recruiting people, behind being visible, even someone like me with the advantages that I had couldn't actually figure out how to join a meeting. So in that, what I'm sort of asking for in that chapter, in which I think about that part of punk, is like, well, what if we could take the punk ethos of refusal, the punk interest in inclusivity and in rejection of all of the things that are brutal and terrible in our lives, but structure it in such a way that it could be accessible to more people.
Right. And you also, just what's great about your book too, is you incorporate so much of your personal experience into the fluidity of these concepts and how they just branch out into different areas of life. And you open with the 2017 Women's March. You know, I was there too. It's a moment of catharsis, but what did you think it said about the concept of compromise and also resistance to the Trump administration at the time and where we were culturally on those topics?
Yeah, I mean, I try to be kind to my former self in that chapter, which is in the introduction. I talk about going to that march and how at the time I felt very conflicted about it. And I still do feel conflicted about it. I think, one of the reasons I felt conflicted about it is that I felt both absolutely drawn to be there because it did feel like this moment of crisis. And I felt in need of that feeling of catharsis that a large mass march would offer. But I also felt conflicted partly because of the, well-publicized problems with the original organization of the march and how dominated it was by white feminists. That changed, of course, as the Planning Commission went on. And also just because huge organized mass marches are not, in my opinion, necessarily the most useful political tactics, even if they do feel cathartic at the time. I don't know if you noticed this, but there was a lot of high-fiving of police officers and things like that at the Women's March that is not...
I'll block that out from my memory.
So, but in that chapter, I mean, one of the things I'm thinking about is sort of, this is what compromise feels like, right? It feels like going to the march, even when you have reservations, and that's fine. You know, this is something we all do all the time, but should we celebrate them, justify them, and say it's the very best thing? So for me, there's a big difference between saying, yeah, I went to the Women's March. I had conflicting feelings about it. I did find it meaningful in certain ways, and I found it disturbing in others. Rather, that's one way of talking about it. It's the way I prefer to talk about it. But I think many, many people in the Democratic Party will just say, the Women's March was wonderful. It was an incredibly meaningful form of political resistance. And if you say, well, then all of a sudden you're pushed off into this sort of extremist corner, in which you're potentially a party traitor or not supporting feminism or a number of other things that I think can get thrown at people on the left side of the Democratic Party.
So it's interesting, too, that the pro-compromise faction is very uninterested in nuance when, you know, in theory, that should be inherent.
I think that's really true. And I think we see that really strongly right now with Joe Manchin as like the sort of poster boy of negotiate with me, where, you know, the most obstructionist person is the person who's claiming to be the moderate. And it's astonishing that the mainstream news media still calls him a moderate. Every time I hear that, I'm just like, it makes me feel frustrated. Yeah.
Well, I also wanted to talk a little bit and dive into your chapter on how compromise helped cement and elongate in many ways anti-blackness in America, because you use a lot of historic examples that I think are really necessary when we're talking about this current political moment. Talk a little bit about that, if you could.
Sure. I mean, one of the most striking things that happened while I was writing this book, again, because I'm trained as a art and literature professor and not as a historian or a political scientist, is that I decided very early on that I wanted to write a book called The Missouri Compromise, because I live in St. Louis and I am interested in the racial politics of this city and how it, how it is a sort of test case for the rest of the country in many ways. But when I started thinking and reading about the Missouri Compromise, it became very clear to me that all of the compromises that I had learned about as, you know, in history classes throughout my entire education were all made to basically sell out the interests of Black people for the purposes of maintaining peace for white people. So that starts with the Three-Fifths Compromise. It moves through the Missouri Compromise. It moves up through the compromises around Reconstruction. In every instance, these compromises, which, you know, compromise is a word that's taught to children as a positive value. You know, I have an 8-year-old daughter who knows that I wrote a book that's quite critical of compromise, but I think still can't quite work her head around the fact that compromise could be a bad thing, because she's told every day that compromise is good. And so when children are sitting in classes and being taught about these compromises that were made for the purpose of maintaining order in the Union, they're going to hear them as good things. But when you actually look into what all of these compromises did, you know, the Missouri Compromise meant that Missouri entered the Union as a slave state, legalized slavery south of the 36th parallel, and did nothing actually to prevent the Civil War, which still broke out several years later. So not necessarily a good thing. And I think that is very instructive, because we call these things compromises for a reason. They do carry the logic of compromise. And if we think very hard about them, they reveal to us the ways in which something that we've been taught to value actually has real problems for people who are often the least resourced in our society.
And those compromises that you listed there, too, also protected capital. I mean, it, not just white supremacy, but capital as well, which I think is important to point out, I guess.
That's absolutely right. And one of the things I talk about in the St. Louis example is that St. Louis was not, was not ever under strict Jim Crow legislation. In fact, attempts to legally segregate St. Louis were overturned by the Supreme Court. But St. Louis today is one of the most segregated cities in the country. And it's absolutely as a result of economic factors rather than direct race laws. Of course, those economic factors include redlining, which was a directly racist practice. So the entanglement of anti-Black legislation and capitalist legislation, of course, is very clear.
Right. And can you talk a little bit about how compromise often leads to, as you say, actually much deeply terrible conflict and pain, even though it's presented as a halfway point between pain and progress, sometimes it trends on the side of pain.
Yeah, I mean, I talk about that in very personal terms in the final chapter of the book, which is about, it's called Compromise and Lockdown, and it's about what we learn about compromise in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic, and especially the notion of the lockdown as a sort of anti-compromising social structure. But one of the things that I explore in that chapter, which is much more personal than some of the other parts of the book, is what it looked like in my house for my spouse and I to be making these constant compromises, and the ways in which our sort of attempts to compromise our way out of an essentially painful situation by trading off childcare, by figuring out who was going to clean the house at what time, actually led us to bury the real reality of what was going on, which was just that we were both just in a state of pain and distress, despite our privilege and relative insulation from the worst parts of the pandemic. And I use that as a sort of analogy to talk about how we often do that as a society. We often use these sort of kind of technocratic compromises to patch up little problems here and there. And in so doing, misery accretes, and we don't deal with the source of our pain and injustice when we don't deal with the violence that's going on sort of under the surface.
Because it's like putting not putting a Band-Aid on a wound, but it really is. It's just like taking Advil when you have a cancerous growth. I mean, that kind of seems to be what it boils down to.
I mean, increasingly, that seems to be what we're doing to maintain capitalism despite the crises that seem to be hitting it with increasing frequency.
So is compromise an obvious manifestation of the late stage capitalism, would you say?
I would say that late stage capitalism makes compromising harder and harder and harder. And I think one of the things that we're seeing right now, which is very interesting, as masses of Americans quit their jobs, is a refusal to compromise when Right. those compromises become so so egregiously bad and the results of them become so unsatisfying that people will just refuse to do it.
So do you mind expanding on that a little bit, and that dynamic that's relatively new about we're seeing the mass people taking early retirement or people mass quitting their jobs and looking for something else? How does that fit into your overall thesis?
I mean, I think it fits in so far as one of the things that I talk about, especially toward the end of the book, is sort of what we were talking about earlier about how that capitalism demands compromises from us. And one of the major compromises is the way that work functions in a capitalist society. Capitalism demands that we trade our labor and our time for money. And increasingly that means in the context of the pandemic, not only trading money and time, but trading safety, security, health. And I think that also the experience of lockdown showed a lot of people what they were missing when they were, when we're being asked to work 40, 50, 60 hours a week. So one of the ways to read the quitting, the sort of mass quitting or anti-work movement that I think is emerging, is that rather than seeing some sort of organized revolutionary general strike kind of formation against capitalism, we're seeing individual people just say that this is a bad deal and I'm not going to take it anymore. And it's showing that with the sort of concentration of wealth at the top, with the concentration of power at the top, eventually working people aren't going to see what they're doing as compromising. They're going to see what they're doing as suffering for no reason.
Right, which is the reality. Anyway, this is your book's excellent on compromise, art, politics, and the fate of an American ideal. Rachel Greenwald Smith, thank you so much for speaking with us today. It was a great discussion, I think.
Thank you so much.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break, come back, talk a little bit more, then wrap up the first hour of the show. We are back, and it seems we have some breaking news. Bradley, in his all of his producing glory, has found that we now have a cinema update. Kyrgyzstan Cinema. Biden was supposed to be having, I don't know if this already happened yet, a lunch with the Senate Democrats in order to convince them to create a carve-out of the filibuster in order to support voting rights legislation. Now, Sinema and Manchin have basically killed Build Back Better. And so why would they, when they have successfully provided a scalp, a big one, for the industries that represent them, and they've had a political win for their purposes, why would they suddenly now come to the table when they are feeling emboldened? That was what I said at the start of the show, and it seems like Sinema is proving me right, unfortunately for all of us.
I share the concerns of civil rights advocates and others I've heard from in recent months about these state laws. I strongly support those efforts to contest these laws in court and to invest significant resources into these states to better organize and stop efforts to restrict access at the ballot box. And I strongly support and will continue to vote for legislative responses to address these state laws, including the Freedom to Vote Act and the John Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act that the Senate is currently considering. I support these bills because they strengthen Americans' access to the ballot box, and they better ensure that Americans' votes are counted fairly. It is through elections that Americans make their voices heard, select their representatives, and guide the future of our countries and our community. These bills help treat the symptoms of the disease, but they do not fully address the disease itself. And while I continue to support these bills, I will not support separate actions that worsen the underlying disease of division infecting our country. The debate over the Senate 60-vote threshold shines a light on our broader challenges. There's no need for me to restate my longstanding support for the 60-vote threshold to pass legislation. There's no need for me to restate its role protecting our country from wild reversals in federal policy. It is a view I've held during my years serving in both the U.S.
That's all I can handle of that. But the wild reversals thing, I'm sorry. Like, okay, let's say you do Medicare for All because you get rid of the filibuster. Obviously, that's really pie in the sky. Let the GOP try to reverse that. Mm-hmm. Do good things and let them have to waste their time when they do get in power reversing the good things as opposed to just cutting more taxes. I mean, But that's what Sinema wants. She's a closet Republican. And the frustrating thing about the Democrats right now and Joe Biden is, like, you go to Atlanta to try to, like, garb yourself in, like, some like ancient Civil War like mystique, or civil rights mystique.
Yeah.
But I'm sorry, the fight is not with, like, Bull Connor. It's not even with the Republicans. It's with your own party. And what do you do to confront them? You just talk about how mad you are. Like, this is a dead party.
What, Bradley?
Oh, I was just saying, like, isn't that just, it's also just like what she's talking about. It's just like politics. Like, yeah, there's always a worry that, like, if you lose power, people will try to reverse what you did. Like, so the response is just don't do anything. Like,
yeah. The response is to, if you want to pass something, you get the 60 votes that I say that you need based on this arbitrary threshold that we have created that I have decided is going to be natural and is more important than is more important than the substance of the legislation that I say that I support, but I'm not going to do anything to pass. She understands that will never pass with the 60 vote threshold. And it's just like, as you're saying, Matt, critiquing Republicans in this, it's like it's masturbatory and only that. And it's only there to just, like, put the blame on people who are not involved and are not in power now. The idea that Democrats feel entitled to power, that when they actually get it, they are unwilling to do anything that cements that power, even for their own self-interest.
I mean, the thing is we have two parties here. One party is attacking democracy. One party is supposed to be cultivating it, because that's the only way democracy in history has ever ever flourished, is like active, you know, fighting to empower people as opposed to like structures of feudalism or capitalism.
Yeah.
But we have a party that has zero, like Bernie Sanders is the only person that like has a notion of how you would begin to cultivate democracy. Everything else is about managing it.
How are you going to go to voters and say to them, vote for me because I value democracy, or vote for me because I am the party that represents people, when we are unwilling to do anything that would cultivate or create pathways for representation? In fact, we're going to stand in the way of it and make sure that Senate procedure and, again, arbitrary thresholds are put up on a pedestal to such a degree that everybody else's well-being and humanity is secondary, to say the least. It's tertiary. It's like 99th on the list of our priorities. And the idea that the Biden administration didn't see this coming is just maddening. And he thinks that he can make a speech. No, you've got to twist some arms. Reference LBJ on the show before. You've got to make sure that they feel uncomfortable, Sinema and Manchin, and the other people who probably feel the same way. Like
Durbin, all those other folks. Yeah, I mean, but Biden's not going to do this.
Yeah.
And like, that's the thing is like, that's all I'm really concerned about for the next couple of years, is driving that lesson home that we delivered these people the presidency, the House, and the Senate, and they participated and collaborated with attacks on democracy by not with through an action.
And again, the if voting rights was this urgent, and it is, because I don't know if people realize it's 2022 now and the midterms are coming up where the Democrats are going to get shellacked, then this should have been the priority at the beginning, and it should have been an all-out blitz where Manchin and Sinema could not catch their breath, when they're not decoupling the bipartisan infrastructure bill from Build Back Better. You make that a whole thing. And at the same time, you tackle voting rights. When Biden is at the peak of his popularity, right as he's entered office, now he's just plummeting because of things like this and his obvious weakness that just is evident with every word that he barely legibly or audibly says.
Yeah, I'm right? Sorry, like, who still approves of him? Like, what kind of freak is still supportive of, like, the job he's been doing?
Just a Democrat voter.
Thing. Yeah.
A Democratic voter.
What is it, down to, like, 30% now?
I mean, it's like, I think it's, what, 40? I don't know.
Good.
But that I mean, and it's because of COVID. So the point is just that now this is the worst time to ask Sinema and Manchin for something. It is the absolute worst time because they just won. Does Biden not understand how incentives in politics work? When somebody wins, then they're not going to give you a win just to like make it even, Z's. We want a tie. All right. Anyway, we are going to head into the fun half, question mark? We might not have Binder.
We will have Mitch McConnell, who was exactly right about this sort of stuff.
We are, I think, going to head into the fun half now. We are going to be joined by Matt Binder and Brandon, who will tell us a little bit more about what's going on Doomed and on the discourse. But for now, Matt, what is happening on Left Reckoning?
Had a big show on Left Reckoning last night. First, Daniel Bessner on to talk about his end of the era of mass politics piece in the FX exchange or foreign exchange Substack. Similar to kind of how our guest today talked about feeling a little bit put out or a little bit of anticlimacticism from the Women's March. We're stymied electorally and in terms of street politics. Both those things show certain signs of promise, but ultimately are not doing the job, clearly. And so we talk about that. And also Jean Bajelan, the second of the TMBS OGs, coming back to talk about Turkey, Erdogan, Enes Freedom, and Gulenism and what's going on in Turkey. So a big show last night. We also talked about insider trading, and we were on Rockfin, and the very first show on Rockfin. And I just want to read a couple of the
what is Rockfin?
It's a streaming service where they pay you in cryptocurrency. we're happy to be invited on. And I just want to share the review. We've got a few comments from Rockfin. People are really liking us over there. And the two comments from the show is, here come the shitlibs, that I in shitlib there is exclamation point.
Gotcha.
Also Krampus, the second comment, shitlibs don't belong on Rockfin. a victorious first Rockfin night for us last night. So patreon.com/reckoning to get the post game, folks.
What is a shitlib? Is it just somebody who doesn't think that, women are workers, or somebody who thinks women are workers?
It's a really hard thing to understand because it's weird. A lot of people who like really complain about libs are libs. Like Glenn Greenwald, for instance. It's hard to understand, but I think it just means anyone who doesn't love capitalism, actually.
Ah, gotcha.
But I haven't been on Rockfin enough to know enough, so maybe that's a misinterpretation. But anyway, we have our two guests now. So
there we go. Perfect timing. We would like... Oh, there he is.
Oh, we also did voicemails in the post game last night.
We have a
phone system for Left Reckoning now. So if you want to join that, patreon.com/leftreckoning.
Bender, there you are. Hello. Good to see you. Long time no talk.
Happy New Year, Emma. It's the first time I've seen you this year.
I know. Happy New Year to you. What is happening over on Doomed?
Well, I did a stream on Tuesday where I basically tore into CNN and their recent segments on how the schools must be open. There was an especially egregious CNN Saturday morning program with Michael Smirkanish that I needed to literally watch the whole thing with my audience on Tuesday night and break it down because it was unbelievable. Things like how one of the things that have really hurt kids during the pandemic is that graduating students who are going into the workforce don't know that it's inappropriate to call their bosses bro and dude. I'm literally not like embellishing this. This is exactly one of the things he said to literally describe the term that he is calling the COVID kids. I mean, just unbelievable stuff. So I did that on Tuesday. And usually I do a show tonight on Thursdays, youtube.com/MattBinder. Not sure if I'm going to be doing it because I'm not feeling so hot today. So let's see. We'll see.
I was about to say, are you all good? Or are you feeling like your voice sounds a little raspy?
Yeah, I you weren't here, but last week I let the Majority Report audience know that I got COVID we were getting better. The whole family got it and we were all getting better. And the one lingering thing I had was like, I had really bad like bone aches, like especially in my back, that never went away. And then today I like went to plug in, my computer charger. And I don't know what I did, but like the most painful shooting pain went straight up my spine. I literally thought I had to go to like the hospital. I thought I was going to be like paralyzed. My arms got numb. It was bad. I was able to lay down for a bit. So far, so good. Still it hurts a bit, but I don't think I'll be. I think I need a rest tonight. But I'll let you guys know. So follow me at Matt Binder on Twitter. And I will definitely let people know if I'm doing a show tonight.
I'm sorry. You should let us know if you just like need to hop off, Matt. I mean,
I will. Right now, this is good. I needed this, to be honest.
Okay.
So the question is, can I do this along with the 3-hour marathon shows I usually do on Thursday night? And that's probably not. But I'll let everybody know.
I'm not a doctor, Matt. But I also had back pain after COVID-19. I kind of attributed to me not stretching for like a decade of lifting. have you tried foam rolling?
No. I mean, this has never happened. Like, I've always, like, you know, I've always, from back in the day, always, you know, not back issues, but, you know, it's, you know, back would bother me. I'd put on some Icy Hot. But, like, today is the first time it's ever, like, literally, I know what people mean now when people say their back went out. I previously did not know. Now I do.
As somebody who has thrown their back out lifting as a, you know, 20, you know, when I was in my 20s, it does suck. Let me tell you, though, you know, if you're not stretching daily, your back is not going to be as supple as you think it is. You're not going to have the kind of flexibility and, like, core, you know, activation you need to support yourself. And, you know, sitting at a desk all day, you got to start stretching, man. A lot of people hit 35, 30, 25. They haven't stretched their entire life. And suddenly you're like, oh, back pain, you know, add into your life, man.
You just sold me. I was already thinking about it. I was laying in bed, unable to move moments ago. But yeah, I mean, I used to actually get general exercise a lot because I would commute and I would not take buses and subways whenever I could. I would literally walk, you know, many blocks as much as possible and back and forth everywhere. But then since the past 2 years, I've even lost that.
I am, you know, look, no one is a bigger zealot than a convert. I went from, like, not stretching at all to, like, stretching daily because of COVID and, you know, like, making me not work out for a while. And let me tell you, those, the back, the hips, got to stretch them.
All right. Well, lesson I got to be better about that too. Are you talking about stretching on the discourse, Brandon?
I would like to talk about stretching in the discourse. I'm still editing the episode. So, you know, the next episode, we'll talk about stretching. But I am, you know, my live streams will, you know, my card game live streams will be entirely card games, you know, stretching and obscure early 2000s, late 90s movie trivia. Like, for example, have you seen Cadet Kelly recently? I have.
I have not seen Cadet Kelly.
Oh, I mean, Hilary Duff, Christy Carlson Romano, Sean Ashmore. It's a power. That's, you know, typical early 2000s teen movie, but a lot of great messages, a lot of terrible messages, too, as, you know, as was the times. But, you know, great movie.
All right. Well, we are going to head into the fun half. Now we'll be taking your calls today. We will be reading your IMs and we'll be doing a set of ridiculous clips that we have in store for you today. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Left is best.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Grandpa.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jab.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good. Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
think that guy might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.